Commissioner Lowell Livermore Jr. Mr. Moore and his father, Lowell Livermore Sr., were signatories to a note, and Mr. Boyer, who is respondent, was the payee of the note. In the district court, Mr. Boyer sued Mr. Moore and Mr. Moore Sr., and the district court in August of 1987 granted an interlocutory partial summary judgment, expressly leaving open the issue of whether there had been consideration for the note. In September of 1987, the petitioner repled in the district court and raised the affirmative defense of consideration. In October of 1987, the court entered its written partial interlocutory summary judgment again, expressly leaving open the issue of consideration. Sometime before the court's written interlocutory summary judgment, Mr. Moore Sr. died. Mr. Boyer then brought suit in the probate court against the estate of Mr. Moore Sr., alleging the identical cause of action on the note. There was a full trial on the merits in the probate court, and the probate court rendered a judgment that Mr. Boyer should take nothing on the note, finding that the note had been fully satisfied, and finding that the actual document that was brought into court in the probate court was a Xerox copy of the original note, which the elderly Mr. Moore had been fraudulently induced into signing some 2 years later after the original note had been signed. Following the probate court judgment, Mr. Moore Jr. repled in the district court and raised the issue of satisfaction of the note and the preclusive effect of the probate court judgment. Mr. Moore Jr. then brought summary judgment, again raising the preclusive effect of the probate court judgment. The trial court overruled his motion, held a trial on the merits, and ruled in favor of Mr. Boyer. In the appellate court, the Court of Appeals affirmed, holding that the first judgment, the partial interlocutory summary judgment, had been sufficiently final to have res judicata and collateral estoppel effects and preclude the probate court action. The Court of Appeals erred in holding that the interlocutory partial summary judgment could have res judicata effect because res judicata requires a final judgment on the merits. This interlocutory summary judgment was clearly, by its very terms, not a final judgment. The court...
Was the res judicata or collateral estoppel, the preclusive effect of the district court interlocutory judgment raised in the probate court?
Yes, Your Honor, it was raised and it was rejected in the probate court. The Court of Appeals relied on the Gracia case in holding that the interlocutory partial summary judgment barred the action of the probate court because any defenses that could be raised in a first action and that are not raised are barred in a subsequent action. Gracia, however, was unquestionably a case in which the judgment was final. And in that type of case, of course, defenses that could have been raised but were not are barred. Gracia was a case that involved a final judgment, and all of the cases that respondent relies on also involved unquestionably final judgments. In this case, of course, this was a very interlocutory judgment. This left open the issue of consideration, and without consideration, there could be no liability on the note. The court erred also in holding that the interlocutory partial summary judgment could have collateral estoppel effect, barring the probate court action. Under certain circumstances, a less than final judgment can have collateral estoppel effect, but there are certain characteristics that must be considered in determining whether that judgment is sufficiently final to have a collateral estoppel effect. First of all, the judgment has to be supported by a reasoned opinion. This particular interlocutory summary judgment was not supported by a reasoned opinion, but was only a three-line document. Secondly, it must be clear that the party had the full opportunity to be heard on the merits. In this case, of course, it's very clear that there wasn't a full hearing on the merits since an essential element of the cause of action consideration was left open for further consideration. And third, the judgment must be appealable or appealed. And in this case, of course, since it was an interlocutory summary judgment, the law holds that an interlocutory judgment, except under extraordinary circumstances, cannot be appealed. So the interlocutory partial summary judgment could have neither res judicata nor collateral estoppel effect and could not have precluded the probate court action. The probate court judgment, on the other hand, was a final judgment on the merits and had all the characteristics of res judicata and collateral estoppel, and therefore should have barred any further action in the district court. First of all, it met the requirements of res judicata. It was issued from a court of competent jurisdiction. The causes of action were identical. There was a final judgment on the merits, and there was privity of the parties. Although the parties were not identical, the parties of Lowell Kendall Moore, Jr. and the estate of Lowell Kendall Moore, Sr. were in privity. There is no definite definition that the court has determined in order to determine what is privity between the parties. However, the court looks at the cause of action that was asserted and the relationship of the defendants. In this case, the cause of action, of course, was identical. This was a suit on the very same note against Lowell Kendall Moore, Jr. and Lowell Kendall and the estate of Mr. Moore, Sr. The parties virtually had the same legal rights and liabilities on the note. Their interests were identical. In fact, the parties were also represented at the trial level and in the probate court by the same attorney. So their representation, their interests in the probate court and in the district court were virtually identical, and the parties were in privity. Collateral estoppel also applies, of course, and collateral estoppel does not require mutuality of the parties. Collateral estoppel only requires mutuality as to the person who is thought to be estopped, and of course, in this case, Mr. Boyer was the plaintiff in both actions. Collateral estoppel only requires that the issues have been fully and fairly litigated in a prior proceeding, and that issues have been essential to the determination of the prior proceeding. The satisfaction of the note in question was, of course, an essential issue in the probate court and was fully and fairly litigated. The lack of consideration on the note that was actually sued upon, the fraudulent second note, was also an essential issue to be decided in the probate court and was essentially fully and fairly litigated. The court really does not have to look any further than this point. The first judgment, the interlocutory partial summary judgment, was not a final judgment, could not have collaterally estopped or been res judicata against the probate court. The second judgment, the probate court judgment, was a final judgment. It had preclusive effect. It should have precluded any further action at the trial level, and the trial court erred in failing to grant Mr. Moore's motion for summary judgment in that respect. However, even if the court were to find that that first judgment, the interlocutory partial summary judgment, were a final judgment, judgment should still be for Mr. Moore, Jr. The Texas courts have not reached the issue of the res judicata effect of two conflicting final judgments. However, virtually every jurisdiction that I'm aware of that has reached this issue have ruled that the second judgment is the controlling judgment. Texas courts have, however, dealt with the very highly analogous issue of full faith and credit to be given to a judgment. In Layton v. Layton, we have a situation where there were two conflicting judgments. This was a divorce case. Mr. Layton obtained a Texas divorce. Since alimony is not permitted in Texas, there was no order of alimony. Mrs. Layton then sought a divorce in Maryland. And Mr. Layton brought the Texas divorce decree into the Maryland court, held that this should be determinant of all of the issues regarding to alimony and child support, and the court overruled that position. The court granted the Maryland divorce, and the Maryland divorce included orders of alimony. Mrs. Layton then brought her Maryland divorce into the Texas court and sought to have the Texas court grant full faith and credit to the alimony judgment. The trial court declined to give the Maryland court full faith and credit, and the Court of Appeals reversed and said that although the Maryland court should have granted full faith and credit to the Texas court, it did not, and Mr. Layton's remedy would have been to appeal the Maryland court's decision not to grant full faith and credit. Since the Maryland court's judgment was second, that was the controlling judgment. Your Honor, this is essentially a similar situation that we have here, assuming that the first judgment...
Your light has expired.
Sorry.
What is the date of that case?
Pardon me?
What is the date of that case?
Layton v. Layton. It is 1976. The site is 538 Southwest 2nd, 642.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Dale F. Carrington will present argument for respondent.
Please the court. It's a pleasure to be before you this morning. I noticed that initially I'd like to point out that Ms. Osmond has not addressed, I think, the major issue that the Court of Appeals addressed, and that is the deficiency of the pleadings as they existed in the district court. As you know, the district court was the first court to hear of this issue, and while that case was pending, Mr. Moore Sr. died. It's without dispute that in the district court, only a general denial was filed initially. Subsequent to the filing of a motion for summary judgment, which tackled all the issues that had to do with this note, the issue of the making of the note, the fact of the amount of the note, the date, the fact that it was not paid, was all presented in the motion for summary judgment. No pleadings, no affirmative defenses were raised until after the submission of that to the 61st District Court. And I think it's important for this court to address that issue when you decide this case. Now, the main issues that I think are before the court are, what is the effect of this interlocutory summary judgment? And can a summary judgment, that's interlocutory in nature, ever preclude further litigation of those issues which it addresses? Which brings us to the second question, what exactly is litigation? Now, the Van Dyck case, which I've cited in my brief, sets out the test. They quote from the Restatement of Judgments. Restatement of Judgments, second, section 27, comment D, says that actual litigation occurs when an issue is properly raised by the pleadings or otherwise, and is submitted for determination and is determined. But we submit to the court that the issues leading up to liability on the note were submitted to the court in the summary judgment proceeding, that actual litigation occurred there.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
You obviously were convinced that the district court had ended the matter because you filed the identical action in the probate code and probate court.
Okay.
So by the filing of the same identical action in the probate court, you weren't obviously convinced that you had a valid existing judgment in the district court. Otherwise, you had not filed a second suit. Is that correct? Am I missing something?
Let me explain that, Your Honor. When Mr. Moore Sr. died, there were two makers to the note, Moore Sr. and Moore Jr. When Mr. Moore died, while the case was pending, a claim was brought in the probate court to collect the judgment that had already been signed by the district court. So it was merely a ministerial act to bring a claim before the probate court. At that particular point, Mr. Moore Sr. had a sizable estate, was the only party that was really solvent in this case. I would point out that
the probate court heard all the evidence, all the issues, and found that the note had been satisfied.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you did not appeal that judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was determined by Mr. Boyer that judgment would not be appealed. But I don't think that really is important or that important to this decision, to the decision of this court, because those issues had already been decided by the district court. And the fact that the probate court refused to give collateral estoppel effect, which I think is really the issue, it's not, I don't think, res judicata. I think it's a collateral estoppel or issue preclusion.
But even assuming that the interlocutory district court judgment was determinative of the issues and entitled to conclusive effect, the fact that the probate court rejected that position and render judgment contrary to it, and that judgment was not appealed, establishes that it is the final judgment entitled to respect, doesn't it?
Well, it's our position, Your Honor, that the judgment of the district court should have been given preclusive effect.
Perhaps you're right, but you didn't appeal that position from the probate.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's not before this.
So why isn't the probate court's judgment determined as the latter of two inconsistent judgments?
Well, if I may respond to that in this way, Your Honor, the probate court judgment dealt only with the liability of Lowell Kendall Moore Sr. and not Jr. It specifically did not include any notion of any liability on Lowell Kendall Moore Jr.'s part. He had no part in that case.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
What about the findings of the probate court regarding the validity of the note on which all this litigation is based?
Yes, sir. I cited in my brief several cases, both of which I think were cited by Ms. Osmond in her brief. One was the Benson versus Wanda Petroleum case, which I think is analogous. And if I can respond in this way. In the Benson case, Ms. Benson was one of a number of plaintiffs that brought an action. She then effectively severed herself out of the personal injury action. A judgment was had that Wanda Petroleum was not liable, was not negligent, and she was then allowed later to bring her suit, her separate suit, because she did not participate in that trial, and that's our position here. Moore Jr. did not participate in the trial in the probate court. It was the same identical issues.
But weren't there specific findings by the probate court on the validity of the note that served as a base for all litigation, the obligation, the essence of the obligation, that is, the note?
I don't think there's any question about that, Judge. But I think in the Benson case...
Isn't that preclusive of any contrary subsequent findings by the district court once the note has been determined to be invalid without consideration, which was the only remaining issue in the district court, as I've attorney speaking? Isn't that preclusive of further findings by the district court when it's brought to the district court's attention, specifically pleaded?
I think it's preclusive as to Moore Sr. and his estate. I don't think it's preclusive as to Moore Jr., who is not a party to that. And that's my point. There's another case that I cited.
Not about race to cut, I'm talking about collateral estoppel.
Yes, sir.
The claim of the creditor in this case, the note holder, is the same basis in both courts.
That's true, Your Honor.
It's been determined to be without any basis to support the law or fact in the probate court. Isn't that binding on you by collateral estoppel of any other proceeding based on that note?
No, sir, because our position is that the summary judgment effectively litigated all those issues except consideration and attorney's fees, and that a hearing was had at a later point to determine those very issues.
So basically, the failure of consideration was the key to the probate court judgment, wasn't it?
Well, there was a difference in pleadings, and I'd like to address that issue. In the probate court, there was a variety of defenses that were raised. That case I know is not before this court, but it has a lot of bearing on this case. They raised satisfaction, fraud, in addition to a number of other affirmative defenses. The only affirmative defense that was ever raised, if it can be said to have been raised, was lack of consideration in the district court. That was not raised until after the summary judgment was presented to the court, but before judgment was signed. So it's our position that under Rule 301, you can't have a judgment without, it's not supported by pleading. It's our position that their pleadings in the district court were deficient. And I don't think Ms. Osmond has ever addressed that issue. How do you have a judgment on some affirmative defenses that were never raised until after judgment was already rendered against you, albeit an interlocutory summary judgment? So it's our position, again, Your Honor, that those issues were effectively litigated pursuant to restatement of judgments prior to any proceeding that was ever had in probate court. If that answers your question.
Well, it's an answer. I don't believe it's a satisfactory answer.
Okay. I think essentially what the petitioners here want to do is to, I believe that the probate court judgment was incorrect, and I believe that she's asking this court now to uphold something that's not even really before the court, which is an erroneous judgment, a judgment that should have been...
Is the judgment void?
It was never appealed, and
doesn't that make it final?
It is a final judgment. There's no question about that.
So how can you just pretend it's not there? It's either valid or void, and if you did not allege that there were errors in the judgment, it became final, and why shouldn't that settle the issue? Your failure to appeal that probate judgment on identical issues made it final.
I think, again, Your Honor, it's binding only as to the estate of Moore Sr. and not...
Well, so what? You were alleging that the note had not been paid.
Yes,
they were,
sir,
alleging lack of consideration and the note had been satisfied. The probate court said the note had been satisfied. So if the note has been satisfied, whether it was satisfied by Junior or Senior, it's been satisfied. Why is that not correct?
Well, again, Your Honor, I'll go back to the first judgment in time was the interlocutory summary judgment that disposed of all issues except attorney's fees and consideration. At the time of trial, petitioners here presented no witnesses. They had not complied with the judge's docket control order to submit list of witnesses and persons that could have proved otherwise, that could have supported the probate court judgment. That was not done. There are a number of cases that I've cited in the brief that give collateral estoppel effect to summary proceedings, two proceedings that are interlocutory in nature. One case was the Lassiter case. Another case that's cited is the Beavers case, which was a divorce case. And they held there that the judgment was preclusive, even though there were some issues that were left to be determined, particularly attorney's fees. Ms. Osmond herself cites the Home Right case, where the plea of privilege, an interlocutory order, was given preclusive effect. So there are situations where preclusive effect, collateral estoppel effect, can be given to an interlocutory order, and that's what we're asking this court to do. I've also cited a case out of the Seventh Circuit, the Miller Brewing case, which held that it was an injunction case, a preliminary injunction case, which was held to have preclusive effect. So I think it's not without precedent to give preclusive effect to an interlocutory order. I would like to point to a couple of cases that are not cited in my brief, but I'd like the court to take notice of. One is the Olivares versus Broadway Hardware case, which is cited at 564 Southwest 2nd, 195, out of the Court of Appeals of Corpus Christi, and an NRE case. That essentially discusses the notion of privity and the ability to bring a subsequent action by persons who happen to be interested in the first case. I also like to cite two other Supreme Court cases on the notion of the defective pleadings that I've raised. One is the Cunningham versus Parkdale Bank case, cited as 660 Southwest 2nd 810, a 1983 case, which stands for the proposition that a judgment must conform to the pleadings of the parties. Again, we point out to the court that the pleadings of the petitioner in this case are deficient in that they raise no affirmative defenses in a timely manner. The last case I'd like to cite is the Ferguson versus Ferguson case, Supreme Court case 1960, 338 Southwest 2nd, 945.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Okay.
Why is the probate court judgment preclusive of an action against Moore Jr.?
Your Honor, it's preclusive against Moore Jr. in two respects. First of all, because Moore Jr. and the estate of Mr. Moore Sr. were in privity. In this respect, it's res judicata. Secondly, it's preclusive because of the doctrine of collateral estoppel, which does not require any mutuality of the parties except the party against whom collateral estoppel is asserted. And, of course, that's Mr. Boyer in both actions. The issues that were litigated in the probate court, the satisfaction of the note, the failure of consideration on the Xerox copy of the note, which was in fact sued upon, were both fully and fairly litigated in the probate court. The probate court found that the true note had been fully satisfied, that the second note was a fraudulent note for which there had been given no consideration. Those issues were controlling in the district court. They precluded a judgment in favor of Mr. Boyer, and they mandated a judgment in favor of Mr. Morse, Jr. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and Marsha will now please adjourn the court.